My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Mary.
Hi, everybody. See and share love. That is it, boy. And that theme, I didn't even think about it until I was just sitting there, and you were talking about it, and I thought, oh, this is just so appropriate. And it's so wonderful. Because, well, I've talked to so many of you over the last 48 hours, and you came and said, oh, you know, you really had something going on at home. And we did. It was the apocalypse back there. And I have to tell you, I didn't handle it well. I was not happy before that happened. And things were building up, and I was running on empty. And I was hungry, angry, lonely, tired, and I had a birthday coming up, and I don't know about you, but I don't handle birthdays real well either. And my expectations were very high, and they were not being met. And I was going to come here, and I was going to tell you all the truth. I was going to come up here and tell you all the truth. I was going to tell you how lonely I was, and how angry I was, and upset I was, and I didn't feel like I was working any kind of program at all. And I was mad at my husband, and I was mad at my family, and I was mad at everybody. And I came in here, and there was a birthday cake waiting for me when I got here. And there were these wonderful cards from y'all and from the women of my home group that signed it. And if that isn't see and share the love, I don't know what is. And my heart melted, and God came in, and I've been on cloud nine ever since. And I have so much to thank you for. But that's how it works, isn't it? That's how it works, and that's how my story goes. And I really don't. You listened to my husband last night, and I'll tell you this: he's got the drama. I don't have that kind of drama. I'm pretty garden variety drunk, and I just love God, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm thrilled that you asked me to share that with you. So that's what I'm going to do. I grew up on the west side of Cleveland in a really happy home. I'm the oldest of seven children. And I don't know what you know about the oldest, or if you have older brothers and sisters, or you are the firstborn in your family, but we are very special. We were anxiously awaited and feted upon our arrival into the world. And I adore my parents completely, and they did me, and we really had everything that we needed growing up. We had a nice house. It wasn't extravagant by any means. In fact, we barely fit into it as the family grew. But we had meals on the table and shoes on our feet, and we went to good schools. And Uncle Joe was a priest, and we used to traipse out. We grew up Roman Catholic, and a very Catholic family. In fact, my parents were and still are very active in the church. And that was a huge part of our lives growing up. Growing up, my parents taught me those prayers. I knelt next to my bed and I said, now I lay me down to sleep, and angel of God, my guardian dear. And I was born on the Feast of the Assumption, so my first name is Mary. And faith was a big part of our family life. We ate dinner together and we joined hands and we would say the Our Father together as a family. And that was really at the center of our family life. There was a lot of love and a lot of laughter in our home. It wasn't perfect by any means. My father lost his job. He worked in television, and it was great fun to go down there to the television station and watch the local programs be produced. And I thought I was really something. At school, my dad's in television, and I was on TV, and that was a pretty cool thing. And then he lost his job. And it was a very scary time there in the early 70s. And we didn't know where the money was going to come from. But what I remember from that time is that we needed to have faith. And we continued to join hands around the dinner table and say prayers. And my dad told us that it was going to be okay because we had faith. And God was going to take care of us. And God did. God did. I got to tell you a little bit about my dad, because he is some kind of guy, boy. He had bald head, very bald head, and very large ears, and a very huge smile that just lit up a room whenever he came in. And my dad and mom, they moved into this old house that was built around the turn of the century and had those built-in cabinets, you know. And Mom had one and Dad had the other. And Mom put all her good china and teapots and whatever in the one cabinet. And Dad made the other cabinet his liquor cabinet. Now, my father was not an alcoholic. However, he really enjoyed having a drink after work. And for my dad, mixing a drink was like creating a work of art. And his liquor cabinet was a sight to behold. It was beautiful. It had glass shelves and recessed lightings, and there was every kind of glass you could imagine. There were cut glass highball glasses and steins and martini glasses and tall, skinny stinger glasses and wine goblets of every shape and big, fat brandy snifters. And he had every type of alcohol that you could ever imagine and then some. His bottles came from all over the world. There was three kinds of whiskey and dark rum and golden rum and white rum and there was all kinds of scotch and there was stuff with branches in it and there was blue stuff and there was pink stuff and there was stuff that had labels that weren't written in English and it was lovely. And in that liquor cabinet, he collected swizzle sticks. And he had swizzle sticks from every place he had ever been, and from the 21 Club in New York and the Stork Club, and they were all arranged by color. But the best part of my dad's liquor cabinet was his recipe box. And he had a card file box, and it had drink recipes on little 3x5 index cards. And my father would think, what do I want tonight? And he would pull out a recipe card, and he would get out his special cutting board and his special knife, and he would get the cherries and the oranges and the limes and whatever, and he'd get all the stuff together, and he would go through the process of making the most beautiful cocktail you ever saw in your life. And he and my mother would sit down in the living room before dinner, and they would enjoy a cocktail. I did not drink like this. This was not to be my fate. But I knew that liquor cabinet was glorious. You know, about the time that I turned 13 or so, something happened, and it was horrendous. The bottom fell out of my life. All of a sudden, I wasn't anything enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't smart enough. I wasn't funny enough. I wasn't athletic enough. I wasn't anything enough. And I went to a Catholic school. I was in eighth grade at the time. And I would, all I wanted to do is fit in with those kids that were the most popular in my school. And I know this doesn't sound foreign to your ears at all. And I think it's something that we all share. It's called puberty. And I wanted to fit in so badly. And I was kind of one of those middle-tier kids. You know, I wasn't at the bottom of the social strata, but I wasn't at the top either, and I just wanted to climb up there so bad, and I was willing to do anything in order to get there. And I was, one night, I was over at my girlfriend's house, and we were listening to David Bowie records or something very 70s like that, and I walked home. I had to go home, and it was in the fall. It was night, and they were building, I-90 goes east to west across the United States, and it actually runs right across the street from where I grew up. It runs right through our neighborhood, and most of my friends in my school were on the other side of I-90, but they were just building that part of I-90 at the time, and I needed to walk across that construction site, and it was dark, and I started to walk home, and I got across that construction site, and from behind the heavy equipment, six boys in my grade ran me down through that construction site and pinned me to the ground and sexually assaulted me. And they ran away. I fought as hard as I could, but it didn't do any good. And they ran away, and I staggered home, and I promised I would never tell anybody. I would never tell a soul. I would never, ever tell a soul. And that was the moment that I felt I lost my power. The power that was greater than me. And it was no surprise that shortly thereafter, I picked up a drink because I was willing to do whatever it took to find that power. And you see, I went to this Catholic school, and those boys were altar boys. And those boys, not just these six, but you know, all of them had a little rum running racket going from the back of the church sacristy to a park across the street, and they were stealing altar wine. So I put my order in for a bottle of altar wine, And before a football game, a high school football game, I got my hands on that bottle of wine and I turned it upside down and there it was. There, I had my power back. And I felt I was all that and more. I was pretty enough and athletic enough and funny enough and popular enough and all those things. And that lasted about 15 minutes. But it was good. It was really good. And then the world started to spin, and I started to fall down, and I got scared, and I started to cry, and I threw up all over my jean jacket, and some kid gave me a ride home on the handlebars of his banana bike and sent me off, and I came up the driveway and into the back door, and my mother looked at me, and I said I was at a pizza party, and I ate too much pizza, and I threw up, and my mom said, yeah. And she sent me to bed, and the next morning I woke up with the first of 1,000 brain-splitting hangovers. And I don't know what your hangovers were like, but mine were just death boiled over. And I could not get out of bed that entire day except to go into the bathroom and throw up. And that's how my hangovers were. And I would just get up and go into the bathroom and throw up and throw up and throw up until there was nothing but bile and blood. And as soon as I told my mom, I said, I think I have the flu. And she said, right. And she knew exactly what it was. She knew exactly what it was, and she blamed my friends. It was the girls that I was hanging around with. And of course, that was the most important thing in my life, were my friends. And from that very moment that I turned that bottle of Alter wine upside down, I had a personality change. And where I had loved and adored my family, they became my enemy, particularly my mother. And there were many young children. My mother wasn't even done having children at that point. I was in eighth grade, and she wasn't even done having children. So there were a lot of young kids in the house, and I just wanted out of that house more than anything else in the world. I wanted to be away from them where I could do what I wanted to do. And at that moment, my whole life began to revolve around alcohol, and because that was going to be my ticket. I remembered those 15 minutes where I felt powerful, and that was going to be my ticket. So I made a beeline to that glorious liquor cabinet. And I got that mayonnaise jar, and I poured a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, and a little bit of the other thing, and I was never going to be humiliated drinking again. And I climbed up into the dormer in the garage, and I taught myself to drink. I taught myself to drink without gagging, without throwing up, or without anybody knowing that I was drunk. By the time I was 15, I had an ID for 21, and I could buy alcohol at the state liquor stores. Ohio was still a 21 state at that time, and I became popular. When you're 15 years old and you have an ID to buy liquor. And I was popular and I had lots of friends and I felt pretty good about that. And my whole life revolved around drinking. Now, at one point when I was a younger child, I learned how to run away. And it was before anything terrible ever happened to me, but I think, you know, my mom maybe didn't give me as many M&Ms as I wanted or something along those lines. And I said, I'm going to run away. And I went up to my room, and I packed my quilt with my stuffed animals, and I wrapped up, I had these porcelain statues of horses that I wrapped up very carefully, and I wrapped it all up in my quilt, and I was going to run away. And my mom said, okay, bye. And I was going to run away, and I think I made it maybe three houses down the street dragging this quilt, and I'm like, oh, I better go back. But I think my parents thought that was hysterical, and so what I got from that was attention. They paid attention. And running away became my modus operandi. And whenever I got angry enough or upset enough or confused or frustrated enough, I ran away. And I ran away in many different ways. Sometimes it was physically running away. Sometimes it was withdrawing into myself. Sometimes it was depression. But I just removed myself from the situation mentally, emotionally, or physically. So back to the action. I just drank. I drank as a teenager all the time. And I went to a Catholic high school. It was the high school that my mother went to. But my mother was my enemy. And I didn't want anything to do with anything that was connected to my mother. I thought, you know, her life was not the life for me to get married and have children and make a beautiful home was not going to be the life for me because that was the life for my mother. And I just looked for trouble. I looked for the kids that were interested in making trouble, and that that's what I gravitated for. When my parents tried to discipline me, I ran away. And I took off and I went to a friend's house and I locked myself in my room and I refused to communicate and I refused to talk or have anything to do with them. My dad would sit me down on the bed and he, you know, I adored my father and I would tolerate. He would lecture me. He would give me one of his lectures and he'd sit me down on the end of the bed and he would talk about God and he would talk about faith and he would talk about seeing and sharing love and all of those wonderful things. And he would certainly tell me how much he loved me. But I didn't want to hear any of that. And I was just looking at my watch until I could get out of the house and go get that bottle of Jack Daniels and find my friends and go tear up. I was asked to leave the private school. And I couldn't have been happier. My mother, I'm sure, was horrendously disappointed. But I went over to the public school. And that was the end of the baby boom. And there were 800 people in my graduating class. And I was easily lost in the shuffle. And we really cut loose at that point. It was the late 70s, and I don't think the culture had really woken up yet to how serious the drug crisis was in the U.S. and right there in the suburban heartland. But we were going to town in the late 70s, and it was easy. You know, school was easy. Staying in school wasn't a problem. School was really easy to me. I never did home. I mean, I did my homework. It was real easy, one of my teachers said, you know, Mary, you really ought to think about going to college. And I thought, college? What, and leave this? I'm having fun. This is so fun. Yeah, and we were pretty much just hanging out in the bars in the flats of Cleveland that Tim talked about last night. And I couldn't imagine leaving that and trying something new. I was petrified to try anything new. See, because by this time in my life, fear was my constant companion. And that fear began to grow in me, and that insecurity began to grow in me like a black cloud in my stomach. It was getting bigger and bigger, and it was beginning to run my life. At the same time, and around this time, I began to experience anger in a new way as rage. And a rage began to bubble up inside of me and come out in the ugliest ways imaginable. And it might have been verbal, it might have been physical, but I started to fight. I started to fight everybody and everything. And it was really ugly. So instead of going to college, you know, people started to do things in my crowd after high school. They started to go away and do things and get jobs and begin careers. And I thought I probably needed to do something, so I started to go visit them in the different places in the country they went with the full intent of staying there and starting my life. But I didn't know how. I didn't have any skills. All I knew how to do was drink and be pissed off. That's what I did. So actually getting a job, keeping a job, paying bills, learning how to live, doing my own laundry, I didn't know how to do that. So I would always end up coming home with my tail between my legs, blaming someone else for why I couldn't stay there, throwing my laundry at my mother and saying, I want my room back. You didn't give it away, did you? You know, she has six other kids, you know, but I want my room back. So finally, a couple years out of high school, I decided, well, maybe I'll give this college thing a shot. Yeah, you know, and I went down to Kent State. Kent State's about an hour outside of, Kent State. And it's about an hour outside of Cleveland. And I was going to be an artist. I was going to be a photographer. And I moved into a dormitory that was full of art students. And they were potters and sculptors and painters and architects and musicians and drama students. And it was really a fabulous place. It was a co-ed dorm. And there were four floors, and men lived in one wing, and women lived in the other wing, and there was a resident assistant, an RA, in each wing to maintain order and keep everybody from, you know, complete mayhem. And I met the RA on my floor for the men's wing, and I liked him. He drank like I did. He drank martinis out of coffee cans, and we smoked joints in the broom closets, and he was right there. He was having the parties that we were supposed to be not be having, he was fabulous, and we found all the ventilation, the heating and air ducts that snake through the whole campus, and we'd be running around and taking acid and running around in those air ducts and coming up in the other dorms, and there'd be big vents in the dorms, and they'd be sitting in the lounge watching television, and we'd be behind the vents going, "Hello, hello, this is your conscience," and they had no idea where that was coming from. It was a ball, but he was an artist, and he was a potter. And he was getting he was working on his BFA in ceramics, and why is that so funny? He was very talented, and we fell in love, boy, because he was just the guy for me. I started binge drinking around this time, and I thought that as an artist, that was my right and privilege to binge drink, because all of the great artists were drinkers. And so we would get in our grungiest clothes and not wash and drink Mad Dog or bourbon out of paper bags and sit in a sewer pipe out by the tracks and build sculptures and write manifestos. And I was very political at this time of my life, and I wrote manifestos about the way the world should be that no one ever read, and I wish I had them now. God, I wish I had them now. We were going to get married, you know. After he finished his BFA, we were going to get married, and we were going to make pots and sell pots and smoke pots and hit the crafts fair circuit. We were going to be itinerant artists. I didn't care about finishing my degree. I didn't care. I was paying for it myself. My parents didn't have the money to send me to college. I paid for it myself. And, you know, what do I want to pay for another 2 years of college for if I can latch on to him and live this life as an itinerant artist? It was fabulous, you know. So we planned to get married. And, you know, never mind that he actually had a fiance when we met. Never let that stop me. I get what I want when I want it. And we got married. Now, he's the oldest in his family. He came from a nice Catholic family in Columbus, and I had my enormous Catholic family in Cleveland, and we had a huge Catholic wedding in Cleveland. Uncle Joe, the priest, said the Mass. And the night before, we had a big rehearsal dinner, and I got in some fights. And I got very drunk. And my mother and father wanted to plan this beautiful wedding for their firstborn daughter. And my mother offered me her wedding dress. And I used to play in this wedding dress. There's pictures of me being very holy in this wedding dress because I thought being a bride was the most beautiful thing in the world. And I would put on her high heels that she wore when she got married in the dress. And I prayed around the house and wanted to be a bride. So she offered me that dress. And I didn't want to have anything to do with it. I pushed it back at her and said, "I want my own dress. You can buy me my own dress." Which they did. And it was lovely. And as I was wiping the bile out of the corner of my mouth, the organ began to play. And there was my father, resplendent in his tuxedo, with his black watch cummerbund and his shiny head and his enormous smile, ready to walk his daughter down the aisle. And I heard that organ playing, and I thought, "Oh my God, I am making a huge mistake." I wanted to run away. I wanted to run away. I wanted to run right out those front doors and right down the street. And that's, I thought, yeah, this is my moment. And I couldn't. The organ was playing, and the paper was down the center aisle, and all my brothers and sisters were in the wedding. Little Matthew was 6 years old. He had his little mini tuxedo on, and so I walked. And we got married, and you heard the dream. We were going to buy a Winnebago with all their wedding money. We were going to buy a Winnebago, and we were going to hit that crafts fair circuit. I don't know how many people, there were 200 people at that wedding. I don't know how much money I thought each one of them was going to give us, but this is where my thinking was at the time, and of course that didn't happen. We ended up moving into a duplex that his mother owned in Columbus, and he got a sales job, and this was not in my plan. This was not the way I planned it. And all hell broke loose. And I was done trying to put on a happy face for everybody else. And I was pissed. And anybody that stood still longer than 10 minutes heard about it. I started to experience, and it was fabulously convenient. We lived in German Village in Columbus, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a renovated neighborhood. It's really lovely. And brick streets, this is where all the German brewery workers or blue-collar workers came to Columbus, and they built this lovely little place that's all been renovated. It's very nice. It's very touristy. There's a lot of restaurants. There's a lot of tourists. And we lived right across the street from a bar, a very popular bar, and that was very convenient for me. So while my husband rehabbed the other side of that duplex for his mom, I went to the bar. And I resumed my, I picked up where I left off and continued to go on my merry way doing exactly what I wanted to do when I wanted to do it. This was the time that I started to experience a lot of physical symptoms from my drinking. I was drinking daily. And I have some stuff wrong with me. It's not that big of a deal, but it's enough to be aggravating and to be aggravated by drinking. And I one of the things that started to happen was I had some horrendous headaches. And I went to the doctor, and he asked me all those questions, and I lied to, you know, with all the answers. And he gave me a prescription for Valium, Tylenol 3 with codeine, and he put me on Elavil. And he said, don't drink with these. And I said, all right. Okay. Don't remember the second year of that marriage. Other than I had terrible temper tantrums, and my husband made these huge ceramic pieces that were hanging on the walls, and I had a terrible fit one night and just picked one up off the wall and threw it on the ground and threw the pieces at him, and I was running away. I would run out the front door and run around the block, and he would chase me. He would chase me with a glass of water, and which is exactly what I wanted. And we just really battled each other, and that's all I remember from the second year. And I took off one weekend. I ran away one weekend and got in some trouble. Got in some big trouble, and that had some pretty big consequences, and that was it for him. That was it for him. He wanted a divorce, and he had every reason to. He had every reason to have one. And I was not a fit wife. And gosh, it was another birthday. You know, it's another one of those apocalyptic birthdays. And he came home, and I begged and pleaded with him to keep me because I couldn't imagine. Just the whole idea of failure of not, you know, that it wasn't my fault. It was not my fault. But he came home one day, and I was looking out the front window, and I watched him park the car, and he had a big envelope in his hand, and it was my birthday. It was my 24th birthday. I thought, he's coming around. He got me a birthday card. We're going to stay together. My heart soared. And he came in, and he said, well, I want you to take a look at this. And he handed me the envelope, and it was the dissolution papers. So I took him by the throat, and I started to beat his head against a concrete wall just like that with the full intent of killing him. I wanted to take his life for making me feel this way. And he was bigger than me and stronger than me, and so he could shake me off pretty good. And I ran upstairs for those Valium, and we tussled, and he got me in the car and drove me up I-71 to Cleveland. And just like that kid with the banana bike, he brought me up to the back door of my parents' house, and he looked at my dad and said, you can have her. And he walked down the driveway, and that was it. And my parents put me to bed in my old bedroom, and I woke up the next morning, and my ceramic horses were there and my rock star posters and my softball trophies. And as far as I was concerned, it never happened. It was a bad movie. In 24 hours, I had a new bar. By the end of that week, I had my bar stool. By the end of 2 weeks, I was dating the owner. By the end of the month, I had the key to the place, and I was the daytime manager, and I ordered all the alcohol. I had arrived. I had my dream job, and I was happy. I was happy, and as far as I was concerned, that bar was mine, and the people that came in it were my friends, and if I liked you, you didn't have to pay, and if I didn't like it, you paid double, and that became my whole universe for the next couple of years. And things just went real fast downhill from there. Did not take long. I started drinking the day after my first husband threw me out, and I didn't stop for a couple of years. And the man that owned the bar was really a nice man. He was a lot older than I was, but I don't know. Apparently, he liked drunken women, which may be another story for him. But he was a nice man, and he tried to take good care of me. But you know, that kind of life is pretty crazy when you're living your whole life in a bar. You know, whether you own it, you're working in it, or hanging out in it. I don't have to explain it to you guys. I don't have to explain it to you. You get it. But that was the whole world, and I was just mad. You know, I was just so full of rage, and I really think, and I think Jeannie was talking about it yesterday afternoon. I was as addicted to that rage. Because that rage made me feel powerful. When I could just go off on somebody or throw one of those beer mugs at somebody or knock a bar stool over, I felt powerful. And I became just as addicted to that feeling, and it was a matter of record each day that I would have some kind of explosion. Well, this guy tired of this at some point, and he didn't want to have anything to do with me, and he kept firing me, and I kept groveling for my job back. You know, please, please, because the other bartenders in my town, they wouldn't hire me. My reputation preceded me, and finally, I groveled for my job back, and he said, all right, you can work here, but you can't hang out here. So I'm banned from the bar that I work in, and I had a resentment about that, because that was my whole world, and I was in an absolute panic about being cut off from that world, and so I defied that order, and I got off the happy hour shift, and I was going to have a beer, as if a beer ever happened in my life. It didn't. I can't remember a time I ever had a drink. And so 6 beers later, I went down to the other end of the bar, and I told that bar owner, my former flame, and the young woman that he was talking to, exactly what I thought of the whole situation. You know, there they go. They're pulling me out by the, whatever these are, pulling me out by those, threw me out of the bar, and we went to another bar, and I had a breakdown there, and somebody tossed me in the passenger seat of my car, and I was kicking my feet on the windshield and shattered my windshield. Went over to a girl's house, and I went to sleep on her living room floor. And I woke up the next morning. It was February 12, 1988, and something was different. I woke up with the thought that if I took another drink, I would die. And the only thing that I can attribute that to is divine countenance. I had never considered Alcoholics Anonymous before. I had never considered not drinking before. I say I stopped drinking for 24 hours. The thought had occurred to me that I was drunk every day. And it scared me so much that I pushed it right out of my head. And I did not drink for 24 hours once to prove to the boyfriend that I could. But that was it. That was it. And then once that 24, I was watching the clock, man. When that 24 hours was up, I was like, okay, set him up. You know, so I woke up that morning and knew that if I took another drink that I would die. I knew that deep within my heart, deep within my soul. And I was petrified. I knew the reason that my husband threw me out, that my parents were afraid of, or that my brothers and sisters were afraid of me, that my parents were ashamed of me, that my friends were falling away one by one, was because I drank. And it absolutely petrified me. There was a man that hung out in my bar that didn't drink. And normally, I didn't trust people who didn't drink. There was something wrong with them. And they were not to be trusted. They were Christians or something. You know, and I had abandoned God long, long before that. And this guy would hang out in the bar, and he danced crazier than anybody, and I had more fun with him. And he took care of me more nights than I can count. You know, I'd be sitting in the back. I had a Volvo station wagon, a 1970 Volvo station wagon. I'd be sitting in the back, lighting sparklers and throwing stuff out the window, and he'd just keep me out of trouble, you know, keep me from lighting myself on fire. So I came to him. I said, John, how do you not drink? And what I didn't know was that he had been a member of this fellowship for 2 years and was dancing on the edge, hanging out in bars, drinking Diet Coke. And I came to him and said, how do you not drink? And he came to my apartment, and we talked about not drinking. And he gave me options. He didn't say, you have to abstain, you have to do this, you have to do that. He made suggestions. And he and I started our programs that day. And I got an assessment. I received an assessment at a local hospital because I really didn't want to be an alcoholic. That was... you know, drink. Knowing that I couldn't drink, I settled a little more with that. But that whole word, alcoholic, was too much to bear. And I went to get this assessment, and the intake counselor said, you know, have you ever wrecked your car? And I said, no. Have you been to jail? No. Have you gotten a DUI or anything? No. Does alcohol ever interfere with your relationships with other people? I was busted. That was it. That was a moment. that it became clear to me that I was an alcoholic. And all I could see was alcoholic in huge neon block letters in front of my eyes for the next 3 weeks. And I had started back to college that semester, and I was doing terrible. I was never going to, I never went to class, and I was getting D's, and I was just wasting my money. And in the middle of the semester, or the quarter, we were on quarters that year, middle of the quarter, I went back, and I looked at the, I was taking a sociology class, and I went to sociology, there's 300 people in the class. And I said, this girl had always sat next to me when I was there, and I looked at her, and I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she went, and she got up, and she moved. And I used to see her a couple of years after that walking around, and she'd go off the other way. It was hysterical, but I couldn't believe I was an alcoholic. I walked around that campus, I'm an alcoholic. But I have to tell you, I went to my first meeting, and my friend John and my friend Megan, who is not an alcoholic but is just the most wonderful support, they took me to my first meeting, the West Clifton group that Tim talked about last night. And at the time, the group is still, it's very big. There was probably 300 people at that meeting that night, and I'm dressed up like I'm going to the prom, like, you know, I don't have a problem. And I didn't want to raise my hand and say I was new. I hated being new, and I just watched what everybody was doing. And if you're shaking hands, I'm shaking hands. And if you're smiling, I'm smiling. And if you're drinking coffee, I'm drinking coffee. And I just started acting like you guys did. And I wanted to fit in really bad. And I just didn't know. I had no idea what was in store for me. But I was so afraid to drink. I was so convinced, and am still convinced today, that if I pick up a drink, I'm going to die. I know that 100%. I have no way to predict what's going to happen when I pick up a drink. And there, I got sober when I was 26 years old. I am now sober longer than I drank. And there are times I think, well, you know, I was pretty young. You know, maybe I could drink. And then I think, no. I just never knew what was going to happen, and it was always bad. It was always never good what happened to me. So I do believe that I am completely powerless over alcohol, and I was soon to become acquainted with the unmanageability. When I realized just how unmanageable my life was, it freaked me out completely. That just made it worse. And I was willing to do whatever you told me. If you would have told me to stand on my head and spit wooden nickels and whistle the Star Spangled Banner, okay, get out of the way, I'm doing it. And I... Great, great enthusiasm, which wore a little thin with some people at times. But you told me to read the big book, and you told me to get a sponsor, and I found a home group, the Edge Lake Women Group in Lakewood, Ohio. And that group was fabulous, and it still is fabulous. But there were women there of every shape and size of sobriety, and they were honest with me. They were honest with me, and the first time I went to that meeting, they were talking about the eighth step, and I sat there with all my brilliance, and I said, well, I don't know a whole lot about this, and a sage, wise woman looked at me. She said, no, honey, you don't. And she said it with all the love in her heart. She said, you know how to drink, right? And I said, oh, yeah, I know how to drink. And she said, but you're probably not real well-versed on staying sober. And she said, that's why you should probably listen. And I thought, oh, all right, how dare she? So I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said no. And she had a good reason. She knew my dad real well, and so she had a good reason for saying no. She was a little uncomfortable. She saw my dad every day. They worked together at the hospital, at Lakewood Hospital. And she directed me to my first sponsor, who was just a wonderful, wonderful woman. And she took my hand, and we worked the steps. We worked the steps, and she freed me of the bondage of myself. She introduced me to my higher power, reintroduced me. And that is the feeling that I had. I had such a great sense of relief when I found step two. And I know it doesn't happen that way for many, many people. But what happened for me, when I found out that this was a spiritual program and a spiritual solution, I thought my dad was right. He was right all along. And not only did my sponsor reintroduce me to my higher power and the concept of faith, but I was able to have a spiritual relationship with my dad again, just like when I was a little girl. And we started off on that journey together. And my dad loved to come to AA meetings. He thought it was the coolest thing in the world that all these drunks, all these bums would hold hands and say the Lord's Prayer together. It was the greatest thing in the world. And he loved to come to meetings with me. So there I was. I was sober. I was in college. My sponsor said, don't make any changes the first year. No dating, none of that silliness. So I got a dog and I stayed in school. And I got this little dog, this little dog that did not stay little. This dog destroyed everything that I owned. You want to talk about learning humility and turning it over. This dog ripped down the drapes. It ate the pots and pans. It chewed the doors apart. It could escape from anything. This dog could jump a fence that was taller than me. It chewed a hole. It ate half the couch while I was gone. But I'll tell you what, I had to take care of that dog. And I walked that little dog to the corner park, and I learned how to pray again. And I said, God, help me to not kill this dog. I need this dog. This dog makes me feel good. This dog makes me feel like I can love something. Please, I don't want to kill this dog. And I learned to pray. And I stayed sober. And I made friends. And I had a ball. I had a ball those first couple of years of sobriety. And there were a lot of young people like me. And we just did everything for the first time sober. And it was fabulous. And we were active in meetings and doing coffee. And the young people's conferences started up. And we just had a great time. So it was me and the dog, and I was going to college, and I finished a degree. Well, actually, about a year or so, our sponsor said no dating the first year. And about a year and a week after I got sober, I saw a guy walk into that West Clifton group. You know, when I was a teenager, I used to think, yeah, I went for that long hair, and just like Jeannie yesterday, I went for that long hair and the black leather jacket and the boots and the tight jeans, and here he walked right into the West Clifton group. And I thought, hot damn, I'm staying. And I thought, this was somebody I needed to meet, so I walked over there and I introduced myself, almost scared him to death. And that was him. You heard him last night. I get what I want when I want it. And I did not pursue him. I lost you for a while. He disappeared for a while. He was getting his life in order to get into mine, but it all worked out. So about a year and a couple months after I got sober, Tim and I met, and we started to date, and it was so scary. It is just by the grace of God that we're standing here this weekend, I'll tell you. Because it was not easy. I don't think either one of the skills. I mean, he had a template. He had a start. But I had no business being in a relationship. And it's just a miracle that we're standing here. But we made it, you know, with the good counsel of our sponsors and the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're still standing here. So I stayed in school and I finished that degree. And I didn't know what to do, so I just stayed there and got another one. I found out I was smart. I didn't know. I mean, I did okay in grade school, and it wasn't anything exceptional. And high school was just, you know, I don't even remember it. But I stayed in college, and I sobered up, and all of a sudden I'm getting A's, like I'm making a dean's list and stuff. And I thought, this isn't even that hard. So I stayed and I got another degree, and it got a little harder. I started that master's degree, and it definitely got a little harder. But it was all right. It was all right. It was a great, great time in our lives. I things were really starting to happen. It was very exciting to be a graduate student, you know. And then the PhD rolled around. I decided to get another degree, so I went to take a PhD. And I went back to Kent State, where I'd started out. I restarted at Cleveland State, my hometown, and I went over to Kent State, where they had a very good PhD program in communication, which is what I wanted to study. You see, my dad had been in television, and I always loved that. So when I went over to Kent State, I started to study media, and media effects, and those kinds of things. And at Cleveland State, I studied interpersonal communication and family communication, and then went over to take my PhD, and I brought it all together and started to study how people interact with media and how their interpersonal relationships either block media effects or help make them greater. So that's pretty much what my research was about. And And it was really hard then. It was really hard. And the reading was unbelievable, and the expectations were very, very high. And I had an advisor who had no sense of humor. You think the police in Parma are bad? It was pretty grueling, and I wanted to quit. I didn't think I was going to make it. And I'd call up my dad, you know, and I'd say, "Dad, I can't do this." And he'd say, "Oh, yeah, you can. So turn to your higher power. You can just hang on one more day. Just hang on one more day." And I got through the coursework, and I got to the comprehensive exams, and I didn't do so well on comprehensive exams. I said, "Oh, you know, I did this out of ego. I did this to see if I could. Now, and I think I can now, so I don't really have to do this." And he says, "No, just give it one more day. Just say a prayer and give it one more day." And so I started to write my dissertation. And the dissertation is a big book. Mine was about 250 pages, and it's a piece of original research. And I collected data, and I wrote a literature review, and did all that. And I was finally done with the book. I wrote the dissertation. It took me 2.5 years, and I finished it. I put together the final presentation. I was set to, you have to defend your dissertation in front of a committee of scholars, and they ask you hard questions, and you have to defend them, and they try to trip you up, and then there's this big scary decision out in the hallway, and they don't have to pass you if it's not good enough. They'll start you over. And it's pretty stressful. And I finished it. I finished the presentation, and I called my dad, and I said, "That's it. I'm done." And he said, "Dr. Stepp." You see, because my last name is Stepp. See, now, you wouldn't change your name if it was Stepp and you were in a 12-step program, would you? People wonder why my husband and I don't have the same last name. Well, would you change your name if it was? Of course not. So he said, "Dr. Stepp." And I said, no, don't call me that yet. You're going to jinx it. He said, "You coming over?" Because we were going to have a family dinner, and it was my brother's birthday, and celebrate my defense. And I said, "Yep, get taking a shower. I'm on my way." And I got out of the shower, and the phone rang, and my little brother said, "Get here now." You see, because when my dad hung up the phone, he stood up and he had a massive brainstem infarction. And he had a stroke and he lost consciousness and he never regained it. And the whole bottom fell out of my world. The whole bottom fell out of my world. My dad was my hero. He was my spiritual advisor. He had gotten me through everything. And here it was, 2 days until the biggest event in my life so far, and he was hooked up to machines in neuro ICU in Lakewood Hospital where he worked. We all went to the emergency room, all my brothers and sisters and my husband and my sister's husband, and we did what he taught us. He was on a gurney in the emergency room, and we joined hands, and we stood in a circle, and we said the Lord's Prayer, just like he taught us and just like you taught me. I have to tell you that I couldn't tell you if I had faith at that moment. I was in too much shock. But the people from Alcoholics Anonymous were there, and they helped me pick up the pieces that night and the next day. And they packed my briefcase, they laid out my clothes, and I went to college and I defended my dissertation. And my friends from AA were there in the room with me, and my advisor, they sent me out in the hallway for that dreaded decision, and I wasn't there 5 seconds, and my advisor came out and he said, "Congratulations, Dr. Stepp, go tell your dad." And I went back to the hospital room and I whispered in his ear, he could call me Dr. Stepp. And we took him off life support the next day, and my husband went and he stayed in the room with him when he died because I couldn't watch my father die. I couldn't do it. But my husband went there because he said it was the closest that he would ever be to God until his time came. And I believe that. I absolutely believe that. My father loved God with his whole heart, and I have no doubt that that event brought God into my life even more fully, and I believe that 100% today, that it's at those times that we are right there with God. God is closer to us than we're ever going to be. So if you're going through difficulty, whether it's, and I know people have gone through loss way worse than I have, and maybe that's you. But just like that footprints prayer says, God is as close to you as he's ever going to be at those moments. In our imperfection and in our trauma, that's where God is. You know, we have picked up the pieces since that time. Now, I told you that my relationship with my mother wasn't that great. You know, and after losing my dad, it was really, it's been very hard to put together the pieces. It's been 5 years since that happened. And I'm really happy to say that things are starting to come back together for my family. It was pretty hard at first. My father was the heart of our family, and it hurt pretty bad. But you know, my life today is exceptional. I cannot believe. If it all fell apart tomorrow, if I lost my job, if it all fell apart, that'd be fine. That would be fine because I'm so far past anything I ever set out for myself. I really thought that I would die in a car accident or drunk or at the hands of some maniac before I was 40 years old. I never thought I'd see 40. And to be where I am is just astounding. I started to teach one class. There's a major research university in our town, and I taught one class there while I was writing my dissertation without any expectation of ever getting a job there. Today I'm running the department. That's an alcoholic. That's an alcoholic. But I just kept showing up and doing what they asked me to do, and I have a career that is beyond my wildest dreams. I was invited to the United Kingdom, to Cardiff, Wales, this last June to present my research, and as a result got another invitation to Switzerland next year to present our research. I'm working with the medical college at our university, doing tremendous research, looking at how communication works in healthcare encounters and how we can make it better, and it's just amazing to me. I get to go on these conferences. Tim and I get invited to these conferences, and they always come at such a perfect time when I feel so distant from him and it seems like life is just tearing us off in two different directions. You invite us to a fabulous place like this. You come up to us and tell us how much you love us and you care for us and you think we're fabulous. You give us an opportunity to share our experience, strength, and hope. And I come out of here feeling like $1 million. And I know that my life is true and honest and full of the Spirit when I leave a place like this. I need to tell you a little bit about... Tim talked about our wedding. When Tim and I got married, my mother once again offered me her wedding dress. And I said, well, I don't know. You know, I'll try. My mom was a svelte size 8, when she got married, not me. And I said, if I can't wear that, I'll have it preserved. And so, you know, I was going to move heaven and earth to get my big butt in that dress. And we did. We took that dress apart, we moved seams here and then, we shortened it up, moved some stuff around, and while we were doing it, we found a grain of rice from my mom and dad's wedding. And I wrapped it up in some lace and I wrote my mother a poem, and that was the beginning of my true amends, my living amends to my mother. I want to be like my mother today. My life didn't turn out like hers, there's no doubt, but I so much want to be like my mother today because she is full of grace and wisdom and the Spirit. And she makes people happy wherever she goes. And if I can have just half of that, I'll be in good shape. She's a beautiful, beautiful woman. I'm close to my brothers and sisters today. They call me up on my birthday. My sister Kathy, after some horrendous loss in her own life, her and her husband had a baby December 30th. And it was like a ray of sunshine blasting through the darkness in our family. And little Charlie, named after my dad, was born on December 30th, and Kathy asked me to be his godmother. I didn't have a god in my life. And she asked me to be his godmother, and I started thinking about this, and my father prayed every day for his kids to come back to the Catholic Church. And let me tell you, I had some serious spiritual adventures. I have gurus, and I've meditated and chanted and done all kinds of things. Something happened this year. And I woke up and I wanted to know Jesus Christ. Now, I'm not advocating this for anybody. This is just what happened to me. And I went back to the church that I grew up in. And I went to that pastor and I made a confession and I also made an amends. Because I had badmouthed that church and the people in it for 25 years because of what happened to me. And it wasn't their fault. And so now I go to Mass. Mom and I go to Mass on Saturday afternoon and I'm back in the church that I grew up in. And it's a whole new... It's a whole new spiritual dimension. And what this has brought me to is there's a theme here, and I'd like to close. I had that dog, and that my dog, Ruff, and she stayed with me throughout my sobriety, and when I met Tim and got married, and we moved into his house, and she started to destroy his house, and I needed to use the steps. I needed to use the step because this dog was making our lives unmanageable, and I needed to find a higher power. And it was, and we whipped this dog into shape. Not literally, but we got her into shape. She was a great dog. Boy, we would take walks in the woods, and all those moments in my life, getting through my father's death and graduate school and the growing pains of a marriage and sobriety and trying to do the right thing and what's going to take me closer to or further from a drink, I would walk with that dog and talk to her, and she was like, God. Like, if she would have started talking back, it wouldn't have surprised me. And a lot of times, that's kind of what it seemed like. And one time, I took her to the vet's office because she was kind of crazy, and we needed a couple people to hold her down while we did her nails. And there was an old man and an old dog at the vet's office, and dog had glassy eyes and had cataracts. It was all round and chubby and fat and arthritic and panting. And the old man looked at me and he said, "That's a fine dog you have there." And I got all proud and said, "Yes, she is, you know." And he said, "My dog's a fine dog, too." He said, "I don't know if I'm going home with my dog today." And I thought, you know, and I think about that. And the day came about a year ago when my dog had cataracts over her eyes. And she was round and chubby and arthritic and panting a lot and taking a lot of medication. And it was her turn. And it was the hardest. It was so hard. It was so hard. I came home and she had gotten really bad, and we had to take her into the emergency vet. And I needed to give her back to God. And this is my message to you. This is the message that I learned from AA. That all of these things that I've told you about in my life, my fabulous husband and this amazing career and my loving parents and my incredible brothers and sisters, my happy dog, my little nephew, my fast little car, all of these things are on loan. They're temporary. They're gifts, they're perks, they're challenges, they're opportunities to grow, but they're not mine. And the stronger I hold on to those things, the more I push God away. And all those things are on loan. And the only relationship that I have in my life that's permanent is with my higher power that I call God. And you gave God back to me. And I will be forever grateful for those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and your wonderful love that took me to this place. Thank you so much. Can we join hands and say the Lord's Prayer?